right. Well, I am here with Denny Carice. She is going to be talking to us today about the opioid crisis. If this is something you are not familiar with, it is certainly an issue that is relevant for our times because it is becoming so pervasive. So she's a clinical psychologist. She's part of the recovery community for over 30 years. She currently serves as the Chief Scientific Officer of Recovery Centers of America, and she's also an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Denny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kristen. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Well, talk to me a little bit about the opioid crisis in terms of the scope. And, you know, it feels like this is something that has increased. Am I accurate in that observation?
Oh, you're absolutely accurate. So from 1999, when it really kind of started, to 2016, more than 350,000 people have died from overdoses. Uh-huh. So in 2017, which is the last year we have information for, there were 47,600 opioid overdose deaths. Goodness. And if you really break that down, that's more than 130 every day. That's more than 5 every hour.
It is really becoming rampant. And I do remember seeing that this was like becoming a more leading cause of death, particularly, I want to say, in younger men.
Well, it's younger men, but it's also younger women as well. And it's some of our older folks that there's really two sides of the population with opioid overdoses. One is the kind of young person that was what we call drug naive to begin with and,
right.
and hadn't done drugs and progressed very quickly to opioids and into heroin. And then if there's an older group also that's done heroin off and on in their life and had some treatment and maybe been in and out of treatment that have also become addicted to this much stronger, more potent, less expensive opioid than has ever been available for us.
Got it. And so let's talk for a minute and just define what opioids, what that refers to, you know, from prescription drugs all the way up to heroin.
Right. So opioids include all the different prescription drugs that would have opiates in them, the hydromorphone, hydrocodone, OxyContin, oxycodone, Dilaudid, all the prescription drugs. But it also includes heroin. And then it includes what we call the other synthetic opioids, which are your fentanyl, your carfentanil, that are all illicitly manufactured right now. So it's the whole scope of drugs. An opiate is something that comes directly from the poppy plant. So there's not much that's an opiate anymore. Even heroin has some manufacturing in it. So all the rest of these, everything but morphine falls into the category of opioid.
And do you think that most people understand when they're given an opioid? You know, for example, I just had sinus surgery, was handed a bottle of Percocet on my way out, you know. Do you think that the general population understands that these, you know, that an opioid that, you know, is the same as, in the same class as heroin?
You know, Kristen, I don't. I think it's getting better, but I don't think they do. And I'm so sad to find out still that doctors are prescribing opioids without stopping to talk to you about them, to ask you,
yeah.
Do you have a history of addiction? Have you ever used these before? Be very careful. These are highly addictive medications. It's just so sad that that's still happening.
I think that it is too. It's very frustrating to me because, you know, I have found, I used to work in private practice and I worked in recovery as well. And my experience was a lot of the people that came in, there was a precipitating illness where they were given a prescription and then they, you know, couldn't get off the pain pills. And then they started seeking it in ways that are, you know, like doctor shopping, right?
Absolutely.
And then when that falls through, that's when they turn to street drugs. And these are people who never in a million years would have sought out heroin from the street. But that's the decline.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting. I always say one of the few things I really like about getting older is that if you stay in the same field, you start to see these incredible trends. So back in the late 80s, 90s, even into the 2000s, when somebody came into treatment for a heroin problem, they had probably been using drugs for 10, 15, 20 years. You know,
right.
It was very rare to see somebody who's like, no, I never used drugs before. I just started about 6 months ago. Now I'm injecting heroin. You see that all the time today. And
yeah.
It's exactly what you talked about. Something like, let me think if I can remember the exact percentage, but 75% of people who abuse opioids started their addiction with a prescription drug. In the 1960s, heroin was the drug that most often led to an opioid addiction. So people come in, they have received, and a lot of them are young kids. They received a prescription for opioids, or they got some from their parents' medicine chest or their friend's parents' medicine chest. They took them at a party. They liked the way they feel. And then you're right, absolutely, for quite a while, there was this kind of doctor shopping where people would be able to go get a month's supply of opioids from one doctor on a Monday, a month's supply from somebody else on a Wednesday, and they would see eight doctors in a month, and they would have all of this access. Well, one of the things that has worked in addressing this problem is what's called the prescription drug monitoring program,
right,
where physicians now are encouraged to look into a database that will tell you if that's happening. And so it was a while before we got that up and running, and then also got interoperability between states. So I'm in Philadelphia, and New Jersey is a half-hour drive. Delaware is a half-hour drive. Maryland's a 45-minute drive, you know. So now with the interoperability between states for that, it's much harder for folks to do that. And what happens is that people start taking them either for an injury or for fun. They become pretty quickly addicted to them. Then they start trying to buy them on the street. And when they go to buy them on the street, like 80 milligrams of OxyContin costs about $80 on the street, but it's equivalent to about $20 of heroin,
right,
giving you the same effect. So people transition very quickly. And it's just a real, real problem.
Yeah. What is it about opioids that make it so addictive? Is it the experience? Is it, you know, why is this one that people become so ensnared in so quickly?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think that we know a lot about the genetics of different drugs. We don't know everything we want to know about it. But for example, there's different genes that are responsible for the likelihood that somebody will get addicted. There's other genes responsible for how difficult somebody will find it to quit, you know, and many other things. And there's different genes for different drugs. So I think opioids are a drug that when it hits the brain, the person has such a sense of feeling good, such a sense of euphoria, particularly if they have the genetic loading for that, that they really want to feel that way again. And then the physiological addiction starts so quickly that it very quickly transitions over to them doing the opioids just so that they don't go through this incredibly painful withdrawal.
Yeah, absolutely. I can remember my ex-husband was hit by a car about 15 years ago. And when he was in the hospital, they put him on a morphine drip and they gave him a button to push. And I remember, you know, 2 days in, he was like a drug seeker. I mean, he was pushing that button. He was waking up and pushing it, you know, and then it was really difficult for him to then, you know, come off of that, but it was done in the hospital. But it is so powerfully physically addictive that I think people who wouldn't imagine themselves an addictive personality might find that this one is different.
I think that's true. And then you also have to remember that with the heroin, this is the most pure heroin that we've ever seen on the streets, today compared the heroin today compared to 10 and 20 years ago is very, very different. A lot of that has to come from where we get our heroin in this country. It used to be we got about 90% of our heroin from Colombia. And then Mexico kind of came in. It's pure. It's less expensive. There's a lot of other variables that came in with that as well. And today we get about 90% of our heroin from Mexico. And the purity of it, in addition to the insertion of the synthetic opioids such as fentanyl and carfentanil, they've just really flooded the U.S. And the stronger an opioid is, the more intense the addiction is going to be, the more intense the withdrawal is going to be, and the more difficult it will be to get off of that drug.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, for people who are concerned about the potential of an opioid addiction, you know, what do we do when we're handed a bottle of something from our doctor and maybe we have legitimate pain? What's best practice in that situation?
Yeah, right, Kristen. I mean, because none of this is to say that people with significant pain don't deserve relief. They really do. One of the problems with that, and then I'll get to your question, is that there used to be these very robust pain clinics that would combine an opioid with hydrotherapy, with massage, with cognitive behavioral therapies, with biofeedback, and they had just as good results, sometimes without the opioids or very low-dose opioids. But when the opioids got, frankly, very heavily pushed by the pharmaceutical industry as being non-addictive, which was completely untrue, and as being something that's appropriate for chronic pain, not just acute pain, which again is also untrue, those pain clinics stopped being funded because there was a faster, easier, cheaper way. So I just want to make a comment that I know mm-hmm. there's people out there with pain, and I know that they deserve relief. But for the average person, if your doctor gives you a prescription, one of the problems we have is that doctors have not been educated about opioids and about pain or about addiction in medical school for the most part, and that's changing, but not much. So they don't have that. And then what we had also was the pharmaceutical industry coming in the 2000s and training all the doctors in a very inappropriate way that, oh, you don't use these just for end of life pain. You can use them for chronic pain and they're not addicting. And you know, frankly, they knew they were doing this. They knew they were misrepresenting data and findings, and they taught the doctors to do it. And so, you know, there's still a lot of docs out there that have had very little education on this. So if your doctor does give you that, and the one that makes me the most crazy is the adolescent kid that gets their wisdom teeth out and comes home with a 30-day supply of OxyContin for what's going to be 3 days at the most of pain, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, one of the things people have to just really understand that the prescription opioids are highly addictive, that the majority of people who develop an addiction start with a prescription drug. Mm-hmm. The other thing to remember is that there's other pain relief that is effective. And I'm not telling anybody they should grit their teeth in pain, but there's a lot of times when a doctor may give you a bottle of opiate, you know, a bottle of pills, when aspirin, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, some physical therapy, even meditation or acupuncture could be just as effective.
Yeah.
Frankly, the opioids are really for cancer treatment, palliative, and end-of-life care. That's where their use comes in. The FDA has developed a checklist for people to ask their doctors before filling a prescription. And, you know, some of the questions are that you could ask your doctor are there non-opioid alternatives that could work? You know, will this impact me differently if my family or I have a history of addiction to alcohol or other drugs? Could it interact with other anxiety or sleeping medications or seizure medications? You know, can I have a prescription for naloxone so that you have that on hand in case the person takes too many of these opioids? Because you're absolutely right. Once they start taking them, they do, you know, for some people, they take them and they hate them and they don't even take them anymore for pain. For other people, they take them and just feel like, wow, this is what I was supposed to feel like kind of all my life. You know, I feel great today. And they will keep using them. So
yeah.
Can they also give you a prescription for naloxone? And then one of the things is, you know, ask them, what do you do with the unused opioid medicines? Because that's actually a very significant problem, you know. And don't fill the prescription just in case, you know, only fill it if you really need it.
Yeah.
Right now, we know the most common place that teenagers get prescription opioids, the most common place they get them is from their parents' or their friends' parents' medicine chests.
Absolutely.
And then if you look at preteens, the most common way preteens get prescription drugs is from their older siblings.
Mm.
So, you know, the according to the DEA, actually, up between 2006 and 2012, pharmacies filled over 75 billion oxycodone and hydrocodone pills. 75
yeah.
billion of them.
Yeah.
You know. And many of them don't get used. They're left in medicine cabinets. There's actually also a problem with open houses, with realtors and people selling their homes now, that people
wow.
will go and look at open houses just to take a look in the medicine cabinet and see if they can find
wow.
some opiates. You know, I mean, it's really a very big deal. And, you know, if people can just call their local township for safe disposal, there's drop-off boxes, there's national take-back days. There's we've partnered with Mothers Against Prescription Drug Abuse, very similar along the lines of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, to provide drug disposal pouches. So some of the things are ask your doctor, you know, why is this, could something else work? What do I
yeah.
do with it? You know, understand that they're very addictive. Fill it only if you need it. Keep it out of your medicine chest. Keep it locked up, and then get rid of it in an appropriate way in a drop-off box.
Yeah. I mean, you know, case in point, I consider myself a pretty involved mom, but I had surgery 2 weeks ago and I've got a full bottle in my medicine chest. Like, yeah. You know, I'm a perfect example of like having that risk right here in my house. And so you're reminding me and motivating me to find a Dropbox for that.
Yep. And you know what? You don't have to have bad kids or misbehaving kids for them to go into your medicine chest.
Oh, I agree.
What we all have is curious kids.
Oh,
you know,
that's right.
How curious were we when we were 13 and 15 and whatnot? And kids with friends who say, hey, check out this. I mean, it sounds crazy, but there has been a problem for a while with these pill parties that kids have, that they go into the medicine chest, take a handful, a bunch of different things. They throw them all in a big bowl when they get to the party, and they each take a handful.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds crazy, I think, to most of us as adults, but I actually can imagine that as an adolescent, that might not have seemed so crazy. It might sounded more like fun to me, you know?
Well, yeah, and they're invincible.
Yeah.
That's classic adolescence. Speaking of, how do we impart, you know, this information about pills and like how serious they can be? Because I feel like there's a perception, especially with teens, of like, well, if it's a pill, it's not that big of a deal. Like, I'm not shooting anything into my arm. I'm not snorting anything. It's just a pill. How do we help demystify that for them?
That's a good question. I mean, it's you know, it's not only is it just a pill, it's a pill your doctor gave you or your doctor gave somebody, you know, it must be okay. And the reality is that, you know, there's a lot of medications that are just really damaging to the body if you don't have a disorder that they're written for or that are addictive. You know, the opioids are a very addictive drug. Your muscle relaxers, your Valium and Xanax, again, pretty dangerous drugs in the hands of an adolescent or in the hands of somebody who doesn't kind of keep their eye out to that. And I think that you talk to them about how, you know, there is this significant problem that I'm sure they're seeing on TV or in the paper all the time, and that it almost always starts with a prescription opioid. And that's just a pill. And really, you got to look at that pill as heroin in a pill, because that's really to your body. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's like we have to impart that to teens, but I think that message needs to be imparted to a lot of adults, too. I don't think people are thinking this is heroin in a pill.
I think you're right. I agree. Yeah.
What about for those of us who may have loved ones who are struggling with opioid addiction?
Yeah. I mean, I get asked a lot, you know, how do you talk to somebody about it or whatnot? And everything is so very dependent on what you're seeing and what you're doing. So, you know, for some people, if the issue has never come up and maybe they got a prescription for a problem and you think they're abusing it and they fall asleep at dinner or they, you know, do things that make it seem like they're taking too much of that. You know, if you're in a position to monitor it a little bit, that could be helpful. But one kind of non-threatening way to start the conversation is to just say something like, you know, I noticed that you're having difficulty doing things that used to come easy to you. Is there something going on? You know, I noticed that you're having trouble getting up in the morning, or that you seem kind of lethargic, or you're not, you seem kind of secretive. Is there something going on, you know? And so that's a way to start a conversation with somebody that either you don't know that well, maybe somebody in work, you know, just this idea of, you know, I notice you're struggling with things that you used to do easily, you know, what's going on? And there's a whole nother kind of way to approach it. If it's your spouse or your adult child or whatnot, who you know had a problem and starts having the behaviors again or goes back, you know, to being more secretive or, you know, some behavior that make you wonder about what's going on, you know. And so what I would say always is that I get asked all the time, like, well, what if I ask them if they're using drugs again and they're not? They'll be really mad at me, you know. Mm. What if you don't ask them and they are? You know, I mean, you can never, I mean, I have asked colleagues, I've asked people in recovery that I've known forever that I have to ask them if I see something, because if I don't and they are, I've missed that opportunity to be helpful to them.
Absolutely.
You know, and somebody who isn't using, you know, if you ask somebody who isn't using, you know, I noticed your behavior is a little bit like when you were using the drugs. are you struggling with that again? Somebody who's not using will probably say, you know, no, I've had trouble sleeping, I'm really tired, whatever it is. Somebody who is using will probably start screaming at you, no, I'm not using drugs. Why would you think I'm using drugs, you know?
Right.
Because they're that defensive,
Yeah.
you know? So it's, you know, what I always say is always err on the side of asking, as opposed to not asking, because you never know when you're going to save a life, right?
That's right. I completely agree. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like the suicide thing. It's like people think like, well, I don't want to ask because I don't want to, you know, it's like ask. It's never bad to ask.
Absolutely right.
And what about for, you know, maybe we have some listeners who are struggling, whether they've, you know, been taking opioids or, you know, muscle relaxants or any other prescription drug. I know Ativan and Xanax, you know, those can be very addictive. If someone finds themselves in that situation, where should they reach out for help?
Yeah, I mean, I think if somebody finds that they've started using opioids, whether it's a prescription or whether it's at a party, it really doesn't matter, and they find themselves caught up in wanting and needing more, what I would say is the faster you make a change, the better.
Yeah.
You know, do not wait until it gets so bad that you are you know, your behaviors, you know, when you get into recovery, life can be absolutely fabulous in recovery, but you've got to deal with all the behaviors you had in the past. So don't let them get, you know, as soon as you, if you think you have a problem, you probably do. And one of the analogies I always make is nobody thinks, wow, man, I think I might have a problem with broccoli. You know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't come up, right? If you think, wow, I might have a problem with this drug, you probably do. You know, it's rare that somebody would imagine having a problem with the, with a drug, and they don't really have some level of a problem. So I would, you know, if you're, you can go to all different places. I mean, if your family would be supportive and help you, I would go to family. I would go, you can go get a free assessment at like at our treatment programs. We'll do a free assessment on the phone with you. You can talk to your EAP or your human resources person at work if that's possible. You can just make an appointment for an assessment somewhere. You can talk to, you can go to an Alcoholics Anonymous or a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and say, gee, I'm not sure. You know, I thought I'd see, you know, what this is about, and talk to people who have had the problem and are in recovery. So there's a whole bunch of different avenues to kind of look for, you know, some people will also go to their clergy, you know. One thing I would say is that if it's a prescription opioid problem and you got it from your physician, then if they didn't warn you about this, they probably don't know enough about it, and they're probably going to tell you you probably don't have a problem.
Right.
You know, by the time people come into treatment, typically they've tried to quit on their own and been unsuccessful. They've tried to cut back and been unsuccessful. So one of the ways to see if you have a problem is to see if you can quit on your own. And the if you are have a physiological dependency, a substance use disorder with an opioid, if you quit on your own, it's going to be incredibly uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. The good news is that you won't die of opioid withdrawal. You will feel like
you'll
you want
feel
to.
Like it. Yeah,
exactly. I always say that you'll want to die, but you will not. Whereas if you're also additionally using alcohol or benzodiazepines like Xanax or Valium heavily, those are withdrawal syndromes that you can die from. So you need to go to a treatment program to detox from those. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you can cut back and quit on your own, that's a pretty good indication that you had a problem, but you're doing okay. And if you can't stay quit, then that's a time when you might want to get some treatment, learn some skills about how to stay off the drugs.
Yeah. And I think people might be surprised to find that most insurance plans will cover treatment.
Yeah. I mean, treatment, it's very interesting. So there's a lot of different ways to go with treatment. If you have health insurance, it is mandated that your health insurance cover substance use disorder and mental health treatment. That is a federal mandate. So they will have coverage. What I want to say, though, is that you need to make sure that you're going to an in-network provider. I'm sure a lot of folks have heard these stories about people who got $100,000 bills after they checked out of somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And it was for drug screens. And, you know, if you're going to an in-network center, and we're about 90% of all of our patients are in-network, and what that means is that that they will have their deductible or a copay, which could be as little as $750 to be in treatment for 30 or 40 days. Yeah. I mean, that's really amazing. And that also means that we have negotiated with all the insurers in the neighborhood and in the network to a set rate. And we actually get paid a lot less per day that way, but it's better for the patient and better overall, because we do not, if you see a psychiatrist, we don't bill separately. If you get a drug screen because we feel we're concerned about your behavior, you know, you're not billed separately for anything else. It's very transparent that there aren't any other service billing that you're going to be stuck with when you get home. And people do get home and get stuck with $20, $30, $50, $150,000 bills.
Yeah.
By going out of network.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, anything else people should know about the opioid crisis?
Well, I mean, I think there's some things about it that are getting better. There's a little bit more education for physicians. There's an increased use and funding for naloxone, the overdose medication. One thing I want to say is that naloxone or Narcan is the most common one. Sorry about that. Is a treatment for an overdose. It's not treatment for the addiction. So even if somebody gives you Narcan and you are revived, you can't just kind of get up and go about your day. You really need to get that checked out. Some people can overdose and they get Narcan, which knocks the opioids off the opioid receptors, and then the Narcan will kind of fade away before the opioid gets out of the system, so they can actually overdose a second time. So one is that if you're in a situation where Narcan is used, make sure the person gets treatment. What's really important today is to know that any use can be a lethal use. There's a tremendous amount of carfentanil and fentanyl coming into the country, mostly from China. And there are people that go out and use heroin for the first time and will overdose and die because it is laced with a fentanyl and carfentanil. And we're having a problem with that being laced into cocaine as well. So it's really a very dangerous time, frankly, to be playing around with any kind of drugs, whether it's cocaine, amphetamines, or heroin. We've seen fentanyl laced in all of them. So just be very careful out there. And if you think you have a problem, just go see somebody, talk to them about it, and just evaluate it and see you know, what it needs, what can you do, what can be helped so that you will not go on to continue to have this problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Denny, thank you so much. Where can people find you online?
Kristen, so I'm at Denny Carice. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. It's Denny.Carice for both of those. I'm in LinkedIn. And then Recovery Centers of America has a Facebook and all those pages as well. And if anybody has any questions, we have a call center that's open 24 hours a day. They can just call 1-800-RECOVER.
Fantastic. And we will put all those links up on selfiepodcast.com as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Kristen.
Thanks for joining us. Continue the self-care conversation with us over at Instagram at Selfie Podcast. And make sure to join our uber supportive community that we love on Facebook by searching for Selfie Podcast Community.
You can also visit our website to check out the resources we've talked about in each episode at selfiepodcast.com. Make sure to subscribe to Selfie on iTunes so that you can catch up with us next week. Special thanks to Shepherd Audio for providing our music. Take care.